Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
And welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? As you probably noticed, that's a new intro. I was never really happy with the intro I was using. I just didn't have time to make another one. I have to thank Psyche Kamir, the vocalist for Psyche Corporation, for voicing that for me. I hope you liked it. It's quick, simple, to the point. Now, tonight, we're airing the second part of the interview with Gordon White. Joshua and I talked to him a couple of weeks ago. There will be, if you're a Patreon, you've already heard this part. But there will be an extra part just for patrons as well. Just haven't put it up yet. That'll be going up. If it's not up already, it'll be up in the next few days. Upcoming, I'm not sure who we're going to have on next week, but in 2 weeks, we're going to have David Politis back talking about his new book, Missing 411 Hunters, where he lists all the different hunters that have gone missing around the world under strange circumstances. Some interesting stuff, as always. And that will be a two-part interview as well. If you're a patron, you'll get both parts right away, because that's how it works. All right, that's all I got for you this week. Here's part two of our talk with Gordon White. So we are talking with Gordon White, and Joshua Cutchin is here with us.
Greetings.
Hello, Josh.
Hello.
And Gordon is out in Australia.
I am indeed.
And we left off last time talking about the other. I also want to talk about some of the prehistory of Australia, too. But when I look at all this stuff, I'm torn between whether or not there really is an other or whether it's a higher part of ourselves.
You want to take that one?
Why would that be a tear? When you go to a non-materialist model, you're essentially then just kind of, in many respects, playing semantics, which is, am I part of the universe? Am I in the universe? And if a higher aspect of yourself is the model that works for you, I actually don't think it does, and I can get into why. If that's the case, it's essentially the same as saying you live in a living universe of which you are a small component. So we do tend to chase our tail with that kind of stuff. I don't like the higher. I prefer a full-blown animist model rather than a kind of warmed-over idealist model where everything is consciousness, because you end up having to do the same thing materialism does, which is to, I call it Brahmansplaining. You have to tell people that an experience they have, if it's a visitation from their dead grandmother, is also illusory. It's just illusory in a different way, which is your mind, which is an aspect of the other mind, is making this up, and it may not be that. I think the higher self model struggles to satisfactorily describe a lot of the phenomenological and ufological information. It probably works at a 10,000 foot view to say the entire universe is mind, but it doesn't work when you're when you're talking about some of the stuff, say, Josh describes in his book, or some of the strange and odd things that go on. It doesn't work as well as, say, a full-blown animist model, which is rather than consciousness, the world is, or the universe is spirit, and there are spirits, and there is a spirit world. That one kind of, for me personally, matches the data better.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. And I guess it's not really a tear. I hold both views kind of simultaneously. It's just sometimes I lean more toward one and more toward the other, depending on what we're talking about.
Well, so you have, and it's just kind of a logic almost question, but to say a higher aspect of self brings a lot of assumptions about what a self is straight away. So it's not just, well, maybe it's a higher component of ourself, and like, well, then what is a self, and what is the lower part, and what is the higher part? And we're already starting to kind of accrete things to the model that may not be in the data, if that makes sense. I have this. I have a preference for an animist model because essentially a magical worldview, as a magician, a magical worldview is essentially an animist worldview. And I kind of Goldilocks my way through all of them, panpsychism, idealism, and landed on animism because it there are two things. I think it matches, I think it folds phenomenological and ufological data in better than an idealist model, which struggles with things like drawing spirits or intelligences into statues and other things that we've observed, like, you know, statues of Ganesha drinking thousands of liters of milk and that kind of stuff. We've observed these things happening. So I think it struggles with that because you kind of have to bend the model, if not break it. But also, and this is a kind of a personal affectation, animism was our first worldview. That is at the bottom of the kind of family tree of cosmologies that humans have been playing with as far back as we can see. And as we were kind of talking about in part one, there is still a giant question mark as to not only where we came from, but where our view of the world and the physical and non-physical world and who else is in it comes from, and the one we landed on first was animism. So I have a personal interest in that kind of almost Prisca Theologia idea. The Prisca Theologia is animism.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
See, folks, this is why I said you should be listening to everything that Gordon said. No, but that's a really good way of sort of drilling down and getting at some stuff that I've kind of had a sense of being my own views as well. So thank you for articulating that so well.
Well, that's been that's kind of a topic of about a third of Pieces of Eight, which is coming out soon, which is essentially, as I spoke about with Dr. Kreipl, animism needs a seat at the big table of philosophical ideas. And it's largely for racial reasons, historic racial reasons, that we haven't put it there, because that's animism is what New Guinean Highlanders do. It's not what Jean-Paul Sartre does.
Now, let's look at UFOs for a little bit here. You mentioned Jacques Vallée, of course, revered in by most of the UFO researchers that come on this show, who, of course, doesn't have that nuts and bolts model, has been looking at it from a different angle since, you know, the late 60s. What is your view on UFOs?
I would say it's a kind of less Rosicrucian Vallean view of things. I think history will be extremely kind to Jacques Vallée in the coming centuries. I think he's actually one of the smartest people who lived. Well, he's still alive, but like one of the smartest 20th century thinkers. Funnily enough, on my show, I've been asked, because I get a lot of people who aren't ETH friendly on the show, and I've got a few people emailing saying, can you get someone credible who is an ETH researcher on the show? And I really struggle. I'm like, hang on, who would that possibly be? Rich Doland is ETH sympathetic, but he's aware that it's kind of a wider game, and I have no idea who I could get on who's still pro ETH at this point.
Well, that would listen, or that he would want to speak with.
Yeah, that's what I mean. They specifically said, can you get someone who can credibly defend ETH as a model? And here's my thing. So I have absolutely no problem with you know, the concept of there being physical organisms on other planets who know how to use machines of some description to move about space. That's fine. And there is a very good case to make that they would have showed up here, because why wouldn't they at some stage, as a explanatory system for the range of phenomena, kind of like we're talking about, the redundant complexity and the sheer oddness of engagement with the other. It's not satisfying unless we live in the most insane universe, like darkest timeline, most insane universe ever, which you'd put on the table, but that's a low probability option. So I honestly cannot find someone who can credibly use an ETH model to explain some of the stuff like in Josh's book or in Jacques Vallée, because it doesn't work.
Well, it's one of my favorite topics that's come up on the show numerous times, but there was this star around which people thought that they were seeing megastructures. The scientific establishment thought that they were seeing megastructures. And it was the first moment where I'm like, I said to myself, if we actually did discover this, that there are megastructures, that the pop culture narrative would be that we'd solve the UFO enigma, and it would I felt at that time what it would be like to be alienated from those who are alienated, because being interested in sort of the high strangeness, consciousness, nonsensical, observer influence, co-creation sort of things in the UFO subject that I find myself interested in. I find it really fascinating what it would be like to have everyone saying that we have an answer. And yes, it is aliens. You're right. And me still standing there on the fringes going, no, it's not that simple. Still, it's still not that simple. This might be part of it, but it doesn't explain, you know, the things that I really find were interesting and that really float my boat right now.
Well, so there you go.
No, go ahead.
Well, the presentation I gave at the London Occult Conference at the end of June was called Campfire's Edge. And mm-hmm. essentially, here's how ETH works with non-ETH, right? So we have just been talking about in part one and recently a way to describe reality with a capital R. So I currently, Chaos Magicians can kind of write these beliefs in pencil. I currently believe in the external reality of the spirit world. That doesn't hold just in Australia or the UK or the US or this planet or the moon or the solar system. That is a metaphysical statement about the entire reality. We live in a magical universe within which it is perfectly reasonable that physical organisms on other planets also live in this same reality. So we have a kind of false binary thing, and the animist exploration or the non-ETH exploration is philosophical. It is a way of using data to cohere a worldview of the entire universe within which aliens exist. I mean, as I was mentioning in between episodes, I spoke to Dr. Brandenburg recently, and I really like his stuff. And it's entirely, like, for me, it is open and shut that there is artificial structures on other planets just in our own solar system, and in his case, as he points out, evidence of a very old weapon signature in the Martian universe. Now that, in the Martian atmosphere. Now that's, that doesn't disrupt an animist model. It's not either or here. These beings were living in a universe that also has a spirit world 250 million years ago, just as we are now. And so if we're talking about the superstructures around a star or any of that kind of stuff, of course, we're going to find that eventually, maybe not in our lifetimes, unless the secret space program is a whole lot more advanced than any of us think. But of course we're going to find these things. It doesn't fundamentally alter the existence of a spirit world or a universe that is alive.
Mm-hmm. Well put.
Okay.
So when you were just mentioning Mars, were you talking about the belief that there was some kind of nuclear weapon detonated on Mars?
I would go further than belief. I mean, the evidence of xenon 129 in the atmosphere it's there. So that's not a belief. The only credible interpretation at the moment is that it's a weapon signature, and it has to do with the sort of speed of the atoms and molecules. Xenon 129 is artificial. No natural nuclear reactors produce it, and we have the split case for it here on Earth, which is we have atmospheric samples from before and after 46-47 when we were testing and dropping bombs, and we have the xenon 129 spike associated with it. Interestingly, this rules out that notion that nuclear weapons were used in high antiquity, because there were very low levels of sort of xenon 129 in the atmosphere, and then they spiked after the bomb. And funnily enough, Mars, on a kind of ratio perspective, still has more than we do now. So we're talking big bombs a long time ago.
There's no. Is there any chance that plasma discharges could have caused it?
Dr. Brandenburg's a plasma physicist, so it's not actually that. And I spoke to him at length about it, and he ran down every option. He was presenting the information at nuclear conferences. He's like, disprove this, please. Like, where is, like, as a proper scientist, he's genuinely running down the other alternative explanations for what it could be. The only thing left, and again, this comes back to almost a Sherlock Holmes way of looking at it, there may be, and it's a lower probability situation, but there may be some bizarre configuration of energetic waves or plasma ejecta from the sun that we haven't experienced and hasn't showed up on like our planet or any other planet anywhere in the geological or ice record that would generate Xenon 129. We haven't seen it. We don't know how that would work. Literally the better explanation from a probabilistic perspective is a bomb, because we've seen that.
Interesting.
Yeah, I thought you'd had Brandon Berg on, but if you haven't, he might be a no. He would be a great guest to have on.
Okay. Because I was also thinking about...
the electric universe?
Yeah, the electric universe idea. Or at least the ideas of Velikovsky with Venus moving in close opposition of Mars. I mean, they've shown that the cratering and such on Mars are exactly what you would expect from electrical plasma discharge.
Oh, absolutely. Like, let's sort of take a 10,000-foot view of the story of the solar system. It's obviously had more exciting periods than it is currently experiencing. That's number one. Number two is we are really just kind of licking the doorknob when it comes to understanding this corner of it. We don't know, speaking of the electric universe, it shouldn't be that the sun is hotter at the outside than in the middle. Why is Saturn radiating more energy than it's drawing in? It's a mess, and it's a weird mess, and I absolutely, the trouble is, this is kind of like jumping down the interpretation hole rather than cohering the data first. If you look out across everyone who's looking at it, I'm not a kind of Nibiru person in the slightest. The official explanations for the asteroid belt are wildly unsatisfactory, and I think that's going to be something quite violent when we finally work out what it is. Mars has stuff on it and has been bombed. There's good evidence that there are structures on, you know, other moons and planets around the solar system. So again, this comes back to this was once a very exciting, if I can use that word, like may you live in interesting time sense. I think this was once a very exciting corner of the galaxy. Underneath that, as to how the galaxy, quote unquote, or the universe, quote unquote, works, self-evidently the official physics that we have is not correct, in the same way the official biology we have is not correct. And it's kind of a many hands on the elephant, blind men on the elephant situation when it comes to the electric universe or Tesla or any of the kind of torsion physics or electrogravitics or any of that stuff. You have some very, very smart people. I quite like the electric universe, but I also like Dr. LaViolette's information. We haven't had this available for public research essentially since Tesla, we have no idea. These guys are doing remarkable work with zero funding, all that money. And I have no doubt that these things are definitely being looked at with unlimited money and the ability to kill with impunity, as Catherine Austin Fitz would say, kind of behind the deep state curtain. We're really just attempting to with no money, to work out something fundamentally very important, which is the physics of the universe.
And I think at one point when I had Wallace Thornhill on, I said, do you think at some deep level of the government they're taking your ideas and working on them and developing things that we're just never going to ever know about?
Well, so I had that conversation with Dr. Brandenburg when we spoke on Weekend Before Last, right? Because he disappointingly, I mean, he's a plasma physicist. It's not really his world that much. But disappointingly, I'm disappointed in anyone who hasn't read everything Jacques Vallée's read, right? But I was telling him about Jacques Vallée and how he quickly, in the sort of end of the early Hynek years, he quickly worked out that the deep state was essentially outsourcing UFO research to UFO groups. And that was one of the, it's a very Nick Redfern thing to say, right? It's very, one of the principal reasons why you get deep state agents and assets showing up at UFO conferences and so on, because it's kind of too hot a potato to keep in there. And they saw that with MKUltra and the Stargate program and what have you. Nevertheless, the research needs to be done. So Dr. Brandenburg submitted his information to the Pentagon, and 6 months later got the kind of nod to publish it. Because he's had clearance, he's worked as a defense contractor and a JPL and what have you. Loyal American, I approve of all of that, right? And I said to him, do you think, because he sort of follows the Richard Hoagland line, which I think is a bit unsophisticated in that people want this information out. I'm like, well, they're not going to go to you if they want this information out. they're going to go to the New York Times. That's not what's going on here. There is an outsourcing of forbidden information that has national security implications. So I think that's what's going on with Brandenburg. I certainly think that's what's going on with some of the alternate, not that many, but some of the alternate physics things going on. What actually is happening? I remember it's something Tesla mentioned once, which was technically you can shatter the Earth into millions of pieces with a tuning fork if his ideas are right. Now, if your job is to prevent that happening to either the entire planet or a country, it is a national security implication to not have that available, because say what we want about the Anglo-American deep state and its sort of destructive influence on the world. That's all true. It doesn't mean that there aren't bad people on the planet. And like the little fat kid in North Korea would blow the place up if someone moved his trifle. So you actually do have legitimate national security reasons for what we've seen in the 20th century, which is, the harvesting of Tesla's information and the hoovering up of any of these very interesting patents and all that. We've got a 70-year history of pulling what I would think is a more accurate physics out of the public sphere for strategic, like obviously that gives, in particular, the U.S. deep state, military advantage. But within that, there's also the, hang on, if you actually can shatter the planet with a tuning fork, I don't think the planet is ready to be playing with that.
Yeah. Agreed. When I was, I used to kind of be into the whole ETH thing when I first started looking into UFOs. And I think most people are when they start reading about this stuff. What actually did it for me, well, it was a combination of things, but one of the things I realized, I'm reading Whitley Strieber stuff and realizing I've had some of these same encounters, but they were in a cult context with no UFOs, no lights or anything else, but the archetype was the same. So saying that, do you think that there is, like that necessarily that the lights in the sky match the encounters on the ground? Like are they... Would you say that they're separate things at times, or do you think they're always connected, or what do you think is going on there?
There's at least three things in play. I think the majority of lights are quote-unquote us, and I think the history of the 20th century has shown that experimental aircraft and so on is when it's not atmospheric phenomena and all the other things. So remove the 95 times out of 100 that they're misidentified. When you get to the last five, I think the majority of them are us. And I think maybe once every few thousand years, it's literally a physical organism from elsewhere. And there are a couple of examples through history that's the best match for. And people who are, if you're a non-ETH modeler, as presumably we all are, that doesn't preclude the arrival occasionally, or at least once, of physical organisms in a craft from another planet, right? So that's fine. Sure. I don't think, and this, I get a lot of heat from this, because I get the heat from the other side, being principally an occultist and dealing with that world. People get very upset when I say there is an association. There is a spectrum of phenomena, as there always has been, that we have historically described as the spirit world. And I think they're scared that I'm saying that the intelligence of Mars is an alien or Archangel Michael is in a flying saucer or so on. Right. Not saying that at all. I'm saying that, and funnily enough, if you look at the mythology and descriptions of traditional cultures, you have that range of physical to non-physical showing up. So I would say it's a spectrum thing. I don't think it's always the same. I think one of the, very mysterious components of it is why it does change how it presents itself to us. I think little lights in the sky are, I would say that's a persistent phenomenon. I mean, you kind of have those examples of in Tutmosis III and so on, where you have lights in the sky all the time, and that's probably an indication that it's not craft; it's something else.
Well, and one of the popular topics on this particular podcast that we talk about are examples of fairy encounters and the fairy faith, and if you buy A to B and B to C and C to D, then you can buy A to D. It's sort of the sort of thing that if you are honest with yourself and acknowledge the similarities between modern quote unquote alien lore and fairy folklore, and you see how well that the fairy folklore also dovetails with magical practices with spirit ideas, then it's sort of a logical extension to say that somehow there is some sort of connective tissue in between the two.
Hence animism.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's I like that A to D thing because I think what. I'm not saying, obviously, present company accepted, you know, we're not perfect. I think there are a lot of personality components that people bring to a field of study they're very passionate about. And that can either be ufology or that can be magic or whatever it happens to be. And so there's a lot of kind of like identity points invested in a particular position. And who like the remaining, I think we're a majority. I don't think the ETH... thing is a majority anymore, but the remaining ETH people have a sort of the kind of people who would hang out in a mechanics. There's a personality type that wants it to be nuts and bolts and things that they can either build or draw graphs of or that kind of thing, and that's a personality type piece to it. In magic's case, people will come to the occult and particularly Western magic for a variety of different reasons, but it very quickly becomes an important component of their personal identity that, you know, they can speak to spirits and it might be the several of the Dukes of Hell or it might be archangels and you get very invested in the idea that you are cosmically important. And to have the discussion in the middle of that, which is that, well, these words we have for beings that appear in the grimoires are probably associated as we find in other mythology with a range of kind of extra-dimensional encounters that express themselves in different ways but are probably part of that same range of phenomena. And they don't like that idea because I basically just told them I've invalidated a personality type for them. And in both cases, that's just sort of the challenges with people being, I guess, very passionate about a hobby.
True. You don't wind up with many people in these sort of areas who are willing to be truly agnostic, not only about the existence of things, but about whether or not they have the answers. And I kind of have been a bit nervous in recent months because I feel like I'm becoming sort of fixed in some of my ideas, which really does sort of frighten me in a lot of ways. Because I do feel like there is such, again, this idea of things being parsimonious. There really is a parsimony in viewing things through this sort of spirit-based magical, you know, perspective. I don't want to remain there for too long, though, because I feel like it's the antithesis of growing as a human being and of being intellectually honest.
Sure. So I think about this as well, and I actually spoke about it with Peter Lavender before the show, and I've spoken about it with Dr. Kripal. I think it's very healthy that you've said that, and it's an indication that you probably won't fall into the trap, because what else happens is paradigms do actually change. So as we cohere more and more accurate, so by volume and accuracy, as we cohere more data underneath our hypotheses, they are naturally going to change. And I think we are in one of those moments now, if I can humbly put like my book next to something like The Supernatural and all this, the kind of stuff that's, and even Josh's book and that kind of stuff. I think we are at a stage where we actually do need to definitively reposition, remain humble and definitively reposition going, okay, so we're no longer, we've left the materialist / ETH version behind. The kind of 70s cosmic idealism one, we're leaving that behind. We're now at a stage, and it's a post-internet, post-Snowden state, frankly, because we kind of have improved data of what the shadow state is actually capable of. We have improved phenomenological data of what the UFO phenomena are. And so like, it's very, I think it's encouraging to hear you say, I'm a bit worried that I'm being fixed in their beliefs. I think you're going to be fixed in them for a little while as we reposition again, because the discourse doesn't improve if we still go around the time kicking circle of it. Is it ETH? Is it this? Is it this? And only have those three ideas. We all kind of need to collectively sit on the new data set and see what shakes out of it.
Yeah, well said. That sort of gives me a little bit more, gives me some solace as well. So that's
well, this is, there are, if you don't do it, and it's kind of an alternate media thing, because everyone's read Cosmic Trigger and what have you, and I have affection for Robert Anton Wilson, but I also have a lot of problems with him, which is the permanent state of agnosticism or skepticism is as useless as not looking into it in the first place. And there needs to be, if there is a language and not necessarily logic, go down the Kripal line with this. If there is a language to this, and if the universe appears to be structured in a linguistic way, well, that's a new thing. He's brought that to the table. That we need to start modeling around that kind of stuff and see what shakes out. The good news is, if it turns out that's all if it turns out that's all not correct, you can always roll back. You can always wind back and go, nope, turns out that wasn't it. But I honestly think we're at a moment now in that Charles Fort dominant of witchcraft sense, where we have the opportunity to cohere information or data points from occultism and ufology and quote unquote proper science and see what happens when that happens.
Well, I think that there are some people who are making great efforts to make everybody play together well. You had mentioned, in addition to the people that you mentioned, I don't know if you're familiar with Robert Ouellette's current. Sort of his current idea about how UFOs, the lights in the sky, might actually be some sort of manifestation similar to a group poltergeist phenomena, some sort of psi phenomena manifesting in that way.
Yeah, I mean, I am familiar with the work. I have some challenge. I have some question marks around people who, whenever they come out of the military establishment with ideas that kind of take the teeth or the scariness away from the fact that, quite frankly, some of the times they are deep state aircraft.
right.
And that is what, I mean, I've got his book, I've read it, I've listened to him a couple of times. I get some of that from him. And the short answer is yes, that may be, it's still a going in circles answer when it's that, then, isn't it? Because then we're coming back to, is it a higher self or is it an animus universe? And I like the idea that there is a, that's a very Ernesto DiMartino field of dreams thing to say, if you build it, they will come. So the more we start to think about these ideas, the stronger they manifest. That's basically how ritual magic works. So I get that bit. I do think we need to keep the fact that some of the stuff, this is what I mean by post-Snowden, some of the stuff is things we're not supposed to know about that are there.
Yeah, I mean, it's a reality that I think that that a lot of people, especially, again, especially the ETH crowd, but I think a lot of people aren't really, I think that whatever you can imagine, it's probably, you know, another 25, 30 years beyond that, at the very least.
At least. We're at an inflection point in how kind of craft move, that if you actually go 25 to 30 years, you're like, we're at speed of sound. We're past speed of sound. So if you actually want to push 25 to 35 years past it, we're in Star Trek land if that happens.
Right.
And how advanced is the deep state, and how is there any way to even know?
Probably not at this juncture until they start to have to use the toys, and they don't do that very often.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things I meant to ask you about starships, because I didn't see it mentioned, but what are your thoughts on a pole shift or something near the end of the Ice Age?
Well, the poles shift, and they do, like they're the magnetic pole switch, and that happens with some degree of regularity. I don't think that as to why, we don't even know how volcanoes work. Let me be clear about this. So we don't know how volcanoes work. They appear to be associated with something like hypothesized gravitational waves or some form of energetic or plasma waves that are out in space that seems to trigger them. Same thing with earthquakes. So I tend to lean towards a more Paul LaViolette idea of how the Ice Age ended, because I think his evidence in some of the mythology and the plasma evidence that he has is quite strong. So the sort of things that Dr. Shock or Dr. LaViolette talk about, I think, is a lot better than Graham Hancock's magical comet that broke into pieces and only hit bits of ice and is still somewhere out there in space and is coming back. And I'm like, what is this, Jaws? I don't think that's adequate enough. So I think space is a lot more active than we tend to think, and a lot of it is to do with that.
Okay. I guess I'm wondering, because when we look at some of the evidence, I'm not talking magnetic pole shift, but like a physical shifting of the Earth from something. And I mean, something from space, magnetic pulse or something could do that.
Yeah, we don't credit these ideas with being relevant at all yet. It's kind of like what we were just saying about the electric universe and so on. So you remember the Boxing Day tsunami in 2004?
Mm-hmm.
So there was a neutron star nearby. It was the day after we got an enormous gamma burst hit the Earth, the day after the Boxing Day tsunami, which is triggered by a very large underwater earthquake. Now, at the origin of this neutron star, that gamma burst was larger than all the energy our sun has emitted in the last 100,000 years. So there are big things going boom, 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 right out across space, and you have this kind of gamma burst plasma ejector evidence showing up around the time you get earthquakes and volcanoes and so on. So could the Earth move? Could it pop all its zits at once when these big waves hit it? I think that's what's going on. And I think that's basically what happened at the end of the Ice Age. I think you had extreme sort of like very large plasma ejector incidents hitting bits of ice and hitting the Pacific Ocean, because it rained for 40 days and 40 nights is one of the kind of things you're looking for, that heavy, lengthy rain motif, which would happen if you vaporize a great amount of water instantly. It's got to come back down, and you start to see weird things like the Kazuzu weapon, which is that sort of crazy finger of God. Some of the Sumerian myths, let me be clear, are really scary. And that's why Sitchin ended up with the whole, oh, well, they were obviously nuclear-powered rocket ships and they had a fight and they went back up into space and were shooting things. That didn't happen. Nevertheless, there are stories of these kind of, you know, finger of God energy beam stuff going on. That would be more likely to be associated with a very active kind of solar event, or even like outside the solar system. These waves come from all over.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You focus on Southeast Asia as one of the places that a lot of culture formed. And of course, we're finally good on Podung now.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to the pole shift, I'm wondering if Antarctica ever fed into any of this.
You're talking about like Rand Flemath's
idea? Yeah, yeah.
No, I don't think so. I think for weird climate change reasons, I sort of have looked a lot at the ice core stuff. The Flemath information hinges on, yes, can the crust of the Earth sort of shift around because inside it is liquid? And presumably, yes. The ice has been there. It's very easy to date ice cores, and they are millions of years old in Antarctica. It's as simple as that. As for whether there was a coastal bit that wasn't, which is the Piri Reis map idea, I don't think that's a very sophisticated interpretation, given that we provably know that things like remote viewing work. So the fact that the Piri Reis map does record a reasonably accurate, not entirely to say the least, accurate view of an Antarctic coastline without ice on it, well, do you want to tell me that over the last 30 to 50,000 years of open ocean navigation that humans have been doing, and it has been that long, the best navigators weren't in some way clairvoyant? So it seems to me, rather than trying to get a low probability model of massive Earth changes, we provably have the ability to remote view places on Earth accurately, and it just seems like that would be where I'd want to go first, because otherwise you end up with we could see it from orbit. And even if the coast was free of ice, say 15,000 years ago, which it wasn't, but if it was, it's still an awful place to live. So you've sailed past wherever you've come from, you've literally sailed through the tropics. And you're like, no, I'll take this place. I will take this place with the mountain of ice behind me and the water that's filled with whales and sharks that can eat me. No food, nothing. This is great. I will found my advanced civilization here. And it just doesn't, again, pass the sniff test.
Well, I guess the part of the evidence, though, too, is that it seems like Lesser Antarctica, the part that leans towards South America, may have been further north at some point and had a more temperate climate, because the ice cores there don't go back millions of years.
No, they don't.
And at the same time, on the other side of the planet, you have Siberia, which was temperate at the same time, which is now permafrost.
Oh, you absolutely get rapid climate changes. That's like that works with the Ice Age model, no question. Especially if it's a plasma ejecta event, that certainly happens. You're moving, so the sort of snap frozen mammoths and that kind of thing. You're moving very cold air around very quickly when you're kind of shooting at the Earth with plasma, right? So that makes complete sense. As for whether or not that indicates that there was, an ancient culture in Antarctica, I don't see those two connected. I think you can probably make the case that the ice out at the edges of Antarctica wasn't there, but it doesn't necessarily mean that is the correct, that's the important piece of information, whether it happened or not. It doesn't necessarily mean that's the piece you need if you're trying to model how we remember the end of the Ice Age and what the implications of that were, if that makes sense.
Okay. No, it does. All right. And Australia has a very different history than is normally accepted by academics at this point. Like, drastically different.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Funnily enough, so you'd be familiar with a woman called Genevieve von Petzinger, who recently, in the last couple of years, has done very interesting research on the similar or the recurrence of certain symbols in European cave art over sort of 12,000 years, which indicate that there is an actual language going on, right? I bought her book. It came out recently, and she still says the same thing, which is that modern art emerged in Europe 30,000 years ago, as in outside of Africa, it emerged 30,000 years ago. That's provably incorrect, given that there's like beautiful art in Ireland, Southeast Asia, and Australia that's at a guess at the 45,000 year mark as a minimum. So not only did people get to Australia a lot faster than people realized, firstly, I think there was waves of migration out of Africa that have, one of the questions I went to Oxford to ask was how are there pieces of archaeological information that fall outside the out of Africa genetic information, which millions of dollars and tens of thousands of blood samples have been taken to kind of put this together. So on a statistical basis, you're starting to get a reasonably clear picture. And I said, does it work that if people left Africa and died, like by definition, they don't show up in our genes, right? So like the out of Africa experience we have is our colonizing effort. Like it may fail. We may all die. And then it could potentially happen again from somewhere. Australia has evidence of cultural complexity that's like alarmingly old. In the case of fire stick farming, it's over 100,000 years old. Now that falls 40,000 years outside of the other earlier evidence of humans in Australia, which means not only is it the oldest continent, Australian Aboriginal cultures are the oldest continually existing cultures on Earth, 50,000 years or as a minimum. So Australia is weird. Australia, and funnily enough, here's another one for you. The out of Africa information doesn't actually prove or say anything about where humans first emerged. We guessed, and it's kind of like a mid-20th century racist guess, frankly, because there were monkeys in Africa, that's probably where we evolved from. But the kind of evolution from monkey thing is just hugely problematic. It's one of the things that Darwin himself was kind of like, well, I'm going to put a question mark around this. Now we have it. Now we have kind of like fat people at skeptic conferences with these t-shirts smeared over them, which has that Ascent of Man thing. And that's a museum thing. They just kind of put some bones together next to each other. There's no way to get it together. So in Australia's case, for instance, here's one that's weird, right? But there are now more hominins and there are enough monkeys in kind of Asia, Southeast Asia, Australia to posit why perhaps we emerged there, which means we then went to Africa and came back out. Because like 70,000 years ago, when we were a 1.5 million year old species, where we don't have a lot of information about what happened before that 70,000. So Australia could very well be, as more and more of these pieces of evidence show up, the kind of prehistory of the prehistory emerging. I find the place fascinating. I'm from here, but Australian Aboriginal cultures were doing things at a level of sophistication at the sort of height of the Ice Age. And I think we have remnants of, I think they have an important piece to say, particularly in the Torres Strait, which are a separate group to Australian Aborigines, but Torres Strait Islanders have something very important to say if we want to, just even for the intellectual curiosity of it, attempt to reconstruct what the cosmology was before the end of the Ice Age in kind of island Southeast Asia, where you have Gunung Padang and all these other examples of what we might want to call quote-unquote Atlantis.
Okay. Basically what you're saying is it's possible we were around before Africa and perhaps everyone else was wiped out.
Oh, absolutely. Well, that definitively happened. So we have archaeological evidence that either... So we have two problems then. So one, we seem to find a new hominin species. They're about 1.5 a year at this point. And some of them are weird and don't let anyone tell you it makes sense that there are actual hobbits in island Southeast Asia. Now, that's weird. To suggest that the Ascent of Man Museum puzzle works when we're finding things like this. There's another one that's basically just half a jaw and a tooth that a Taiwanese fisherman pulled out of the water while fishing, which is another new species. So it's really starting to look like some kind of Middle Earth thing going on in island Southeast Asia, which is where we lost so much of our land. Well, more of it, like an area twice the size of India went underwater in that corner of the world at the end of the Ice Age. And it also has right. step pyramids that are at least 20,000 years old. It has some of the earliest evidence of sort of art outside of Africa at a hugely symbolic level. And in the case of the Torres Strait Islanders, it has a story of a sunken land and also some explicit and extremely complex astrotheology and star-based calendars that they have been running to since they got to the Torres Strait, which they did at the end of the Ice Age. So we kind of have pieces. We need to build the car. Like, we actually have the pieces we need to kind of start to paint a picture of what this world was. And that's, yeah, definitely maybe the first sort of quarter of Starships.
And I would perhaps suggest that the lack of emphasis put on island Southeast Asia in this narrative is possibly also just an outgrowth of just basically Western attitudes. I mean, I feel like basically every other corner of the world gets more attention in America than island Southeast Asia.
Absolutely.
You know, we just, I mean, like, Americans just don't even think about it. If you were to ask them to list places, I mean, they can't, most Americans probably can't even tell you the dominant religion of the region. And I think it's sort of an out of sight, out of mind thing. And I wonder if there's also sort of a racial narrative that's been appended to that too. And in terms of ignoring it.
Yeah, it's definitely both. So the interest in this stuff came from childhood, and I started studying island Southeast Asia, well, the prehistory of it and the prehistory of the Pacific at university here in Australia. For context, my grandfather was part of colonial administration in New Guinea, so he sort of ran parts of it that appear in the book, which means my aunt was born on the river that I talk about it when I open the book, and that's where my father grew up. His best friend was a pig. Like, it was a very odd world. So I have a kind of family connection to the area, which probably kickstarted my interest in it. When it was kind of mapped and absorbed into the European empires of the time, it was sort of the last place, in particular the Pacific, was the last place to be put into maps and stories of where the world came from by Europeans. So it's this weird, I use this example at university, and I think it works, which is by the time they got there, it's like a jigsaw, and you have one piece left, which is this little corner of the world, and you go to put the piece in, and the piece doesn't fit the one remaining slot in your jigsaw. And that's well, but when you go, oh. And what we've done is essentially just Homer Simpson fist mash it into place, but it doesn't fit. And if that piece doesn't fit, guess what that says about the picture you've just spent 150 years putting together? It's not correct. And Island Southeast Asia is that, and there's a reason why people don't want to look at it. The politics of it is fascinating. The academic politics of the population, or the peopling rather, of the Pacific is the most reality show, personal politic, backstabbing, just academia squared stuff you could ever hope to, because it doesn't work and no one wants to look at it. If they look at it, it unravels Australia and kind of that corner of Eurasia, which means it unravels Central Eurasia, which means it unravels the kind of jewel of our Indo-European, which is an unfashionable word and quite rightly so, but it unravels the sort of Indo-European project of where we came from and how that works. The whole thing falls apart, and that's why I've been picking at it for 20 years, because it should fall apart.
Okay. You mentioned diving on Nan Madol early in the book. Tell people a little bit about Nan Madol.
Nan Madol is a... It's called the Venice of the Pacific, and it is a city that's built out on a reef and a mangrove swamp, and it stretches about 11 square miles and is built of millions of tons of prismatic basalt logs. And it's off the sort of corner of an island in Micronesia called Ponape. And Graham Hancock went there, and I'll tell you that story in a minute, for his original kind of classic fingerprint sort of gods situation. When I went to shoot my documentary, we had the same dive instructors and dive guides and so on to kind of look at it, because Nan Madol, the story of it, essentially built by two brothers who used magic to bring these prismatic basalt logs from the other side of the island. Ponape is essentially a mangrove wreathed or ringed mountain. There's no beaches. It's not a very good tourist destination in that respect, although there are little outlying beaches which are stunning on tiny little islands. It's a mountainous interior, and they're moving logs that there aren't cranes on the island that can lift. And this, it appears to have been built around the 1000 AD mark, based on the kind of when that bit of land was and wasn't above water, because it's people don't seem to realize that you know, land sinks beneath the sea and shows up outside of ice ages. It happens with subsidence and that kind of thing. So we have this sort of city of the dead built in a between zone, which I think is very deliberate. So a mangrove swamp is neither ocean nor land. That's a very good place to put a city of the dead, which is what it is. It's a tomb city. We don't know how it was built, as in these specific logs, and every attempt, much like the pyramids, every attempt to kind of put a log on a raft, the raft just sinks. So something weird happened 1,000 years ago that hasn't really been looked at. But why it interested Graham Hancock initially is that it was built as a mirror of a city underneath the sea right next to it. And there was some evidence that was there, and you'll see video of him kind of finding these two pillars, which I went and saw. They're coral pinnacles. They're not actually pillars. But nevertheless, you have a city of the dead that we don't know how it was built 1,000 years ago to match a memory of an earlier city underneath the water that has very similar construction material and ways of being put together that you actually find in Gunung Padang. So there is something enigmatic and strange that indicates that there is a survival of the story, if not the actual builders. So the hypothesis that it was actual survivors of Atlantis who went, you know, quote-unquote Atlantis, who built Nan Madol, not correct. The timeline is off by about 8,000 years. Right. The idea that it is a retained memory and capacity of a culture that was, you know, just to the south. I say just to the south, it's still, you know, open ocean. Just to the south a few thousand years ago, well, that works a lot better.
And you see some of these structures like, what's the big one? Man, I'm drawing a blank on it, in Cambodia.
Angkor Wat?
Yes, like Angkor Wat, which we know wasn't built way back, but seems to have the same stuff, the same message in it.
Yeah, it does. One of the things that it won't happen because there's no money, and we've discussed the politics of academia, right? But what Gunung Padang and Göbekli Tepe should do, and this is something Graham Hancock is correct about, is they should, their existence should invite us to reconsider the age of the sort of oldest statues or temples or whatever that you find in India and Pakistan and other places, because just as we saw in Egypt over the dynastic era, temples would move as the stars processed. So that if you have temples that are aligned to specific stars or so on, you had to keep moving it or the magic of it wouldn't work. And you see that in dozens of sites across Egypt, that because it was such a long-lived culture, they had to move it. Now, that means that they were built and rebuilt quite frenetically. And in fact, you have kings in the Middle Kingdom declaring that they hadn't reused stone from older buildings because that was against the law of the gods. They hadn't reused stone from older buildings in constructing their own temples. That was one of the things that they would declare in Osiris's court to make sure they could, you know, get through. The existence of very complex and confident use of megalithic architecture invites us, because it's very difficult to date stone, and in fact there are no kind of officially accepted ways of doing so, which means these buildings that we have that are very, very old, particularly in the subcontinent, so particularly in the kind of India area, are probably a lot older than that, because we have one effectively just down the road, Gunung Padang, that's 20,000 years old. So why isn't this, like, why aren't the earliest layers of this, which we can't date, now that we know that we were building at that level, why aren't they at least hypothetically said, well, what happens if they're this old? And these are the pieces that start to open up, that increases our sort of opportunity to look at how complex our distant ancestors were. It's essentially an arbitrary definition to say that, you know, these buildings are only a few thousand years old if you can't correctly date them.
Yeah. Okay. Josh, do you have more for him before we end up without time?
There's actually something that I'm sort of the cryptid guy on this show, I feel like. I feel like I have more of an interest in that stuff than a lot of people. And I know that you've mentioned in passing, I can't recall which interview it was on, but what is your take on a lot of cryptozoology? I mean, I've come around begrudgingly to the fact that there probably isn't an 8-foot tall hairy hominid running around North America. In spite of, you know, fossil evidence to the contrary, I don't think that that's really necessarily the answer right now. Doesn't mean that something's not happening. But how do you? What are your thoughts on stuff like Bigfoot or you know, other stuff like that?
As a non-American, let me tell you, only Americans are interested in Bigfoot. like no one else cares at all. and it's funny when it, because I listen to a lot of these kind of, you know, paranormal or 14 or whatever podcasts, and it's I roll my eyes when it's a Bigfoot one because we don't care. I think you're correct. I think you're correct that that it's patently not like a survival of an unacknowledged survival of something that's continued unmolested through the millennia. I think Bigfoot and I quite like cryptids, I guess, but like if you've read a few too many grimoires, you see these spirits and they look ridiculous. They have like, yep, chicken legs and a crown and a cutlass, and they'll teach you nautical engineering, and it matches a lot of the kind of weird fringe of UFO encounters. So this is the bit that really annoys magicians, by the way. It's more popular with ufologists and people interested in that side of it. But people don't like to hear that there is that Bigfoot may be an example of the kind of things that people describe in the grimoires, which I'm very specific in saying it that way. I actually think in Bigfoot's case, in some instances, it's even more specific than that. I think we get into almost like the TV show Fringe. I think in some cases they are literally temporary dimensional visitors because because they are, as much as I can, you know, when I sort of endure the Bigfoot paranormal podcast episodes, the as you say, the physical evidence is quite good, and it's not the same kind of weird enigmatic radiation effect. Not always, not the same weird enigmatic radiation effect stuff. Sometimes it's like hair and feces. Like this, I wonder if there isn't a piece of it that isn't like when Terence McKenna was first told about by the mushroom about time wave zero. He says he was told that every moment in time is an overlay of five other moments in time. That's how it all works together. And I wonder if there isn't, I mean, that was a mushroom who told him that, but I wonder if that kind of like in the blind man and the elephant situation isn't occasionally what we see in cryptozoology, where it is an overlap from either another dimension or another place, either backwards in time or frankly forwards in time. We don't know what's going to happen.
Right. I mean, and that certainly does resonate. Something else, you know, just coming back to this idea, this concept of grimoire representation and sort of cryptozoological phenomena. There's, I don't know if you've been aware of this, but everybody's, one of the hot topics in cryptozoology now is dog man. I don't know if are you familiar with this?
I am. I am. I have you in Chaos Protocols. I have a lot about the work of David Gordon White.
Okay.
No relation, obviously. I love his Myths of the Dogmen book. That is the Dogmen thing interests me because
it's a therianthropic representation of a dog-headed deity is what I see every time I hear about it.
Yeah, and there are survivals of that essentially up into the early modern period. So some of the most popular saints in Europe, like St. Christopher, were either from the land of the dogs or dog-headed or accompanied by dogmen. And there's a cluster of saints in France that it's just, I mean, we're in the dog days now, or at least you guys are. It's winter here.
Right.
Where you have St. Guinevere and all these other saints that are either actual dogs or dog-headed, so retained within the kind of folk magic of Europe, you have these beings. So that's where, there's a lot of that in my book, The Chaos Protocols, because I find some of these forms magically very useful to work with, because Hermanibus is an important kind of god that I work with, which is the Hermes-Anubis blend that came out of the classical world. And he seems to have survived, and quite literally you would have dog-headed statues of depictions of St. Christopher at the gates to European towns or bridges, like in Sweden up until the sort of late 1600s, because obviously St. Christopher is the protector of travelers. So this dog St. Christopher, who brings the light from the other world across, he literally carries Christ over the mountains, right? So you have this continuation of this dog form, dog man idea in essentially folk magic, right up until very recently.
Right, and it's, you know, it's interesting thinking of this dog representation having to do with travel. I mean, you sort of spin off there from there into, you know, the black dog at the crossroads sort of iconography that you see.
Thus, Hecate and so on, because Hecate is sort of the goddess of dogs and the crossroads, and people would, you know, sacrifice dogs to her at crossroads and so on.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the reason I asked that is because I remember reading in Starships about therianthropic dog-headed gods and thinking, I wonder if that somehow, you know, is something about is tapping into that same sort of vein with these new sightings that people are having and trying so hard to force into the materialist basket, just like
I know it's kind of embarrassing, but there's more. So in Chaos Protocols, there are actual ways to work with dog-headed saints from a beginner's magical point of view, and it is interesting. The Hermanibus form is something that I've been working with 5-6 years. So it's interesting that it's appeared in magic as like sort of emerging from the gloom of wherever these ideas come from back into popularity. And it's also appearing in a similar timeline as sighting somewhere, which does again suggest not only an external reality, but these two things are associated in some way.
Fascinating.
All right, so I guess we should wrap up at this point. Tell people about your published two books real quick.
Sure. So Starships, A Prehistory of the Spirits, which we spent most of the time talking about. Don't look for it on Amazon. It's an independent art publisher in the UK called Scarlet Imprint. So you'll get the best book there. There are some secondhand ones on Amazon that are a couple of $100. That's not what the book costs. So scarletimprint.com. The Chaos Protocols is a normally published book. So that is available on Amazon. So you can find that one there. And my blog and podcast is runesoup.com. I have a RuneSoup Facebook page, but I don't use Facebook personally. If you want to chat to me, I love Twitter. So that's Gordon, G-O-I-D-O-N underscore White, W-H-I-T-E.
Okay, and RuneSoup is an excellent podcast, and people should definitely check that one out. It's one of the few I still listen to regularly.
Very nice to hear. Thank you.
And do you have a new book coming out when?
End of this month, Pieces of Eight. Again, you'll find information about that at the site or the Facebook page.
All right. Thank you so much, Gordon.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure.
Yes, thank you so much.
All right, there you go. That concludes the Gordon White interview. Like I said, there's about 20 extra minutes I'm going to put up for Patreons. If you want to become a Patreon, it's only $3. It helps us out an enormous amount as we're trying to expand the show as much as possible. The extra bit with Gordon, if I remember right, we talked about evolution and we talked about giants. All right. So, to close things out tonight, I think we're going to play some John Stickley Trio. And this band is just really, really impressed me. I heard them initially on the Grailian Report, Micah Hank's weekly show, and was just, it just stuck out to me enormously. And this is a track from them called Point to Point. See you next week.
We'll be right back.